Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, is Jonathan Lindemann.
My pleasure, Johnny.
James Jones.
I'm going to wrap you in my mentals.
Yes. And in a very sorry state, indeed, is Greg Leahy.
Hello.
He can't even summon up an ahoy, ahoy.
It's too many syllables for that.
Yeah, we're going to try to minimize how much Greg has to talk on here. I don't know how successful it will be, but...
You see, it'll be better once I get going.
Yes, Greg shot himself hoarse from the weekend football, but we'll get into that a little bit later, I think, in listener mail, which will come up in the second segment. So first up, we've got new business. And actually, Greg, I figured I'd let you go first unless you want to warm up.
No, I'm good to go. A lot to get through. So my new business this week has a common theme. It's all about things coming to an end. So I've been making my way towards the end of my second playthrough of Wind Waker. You know, where you're in Link's pajamas and you get to hear all the old ancient Hylian dialogue that was gibberish in the first playthrough. That's nice. I collected all the treasures in Warrior World.
Hey!
Finally. That took a while, even though it's quite a short game, as most reviews would say. And I am actually finally going to get around to getting the true ending in Castlevania Aria of Sorrow.
Wow.
Which is on my Game Boy... Oh, that's my new business from September 2003. I don't know why that would be the... Oh, that's the last time we beat the New England Patriots. That must be it. I'm sorry about that.
I thought you were serious for a while there. I was like, wow, I didn't know Greg had been playing these games.
But you know who's not playing games? The Buffalo Bills. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. Winning games.
Oh, Greg can finally change his... So, Greg, you can finally change your socks now.
Oh, God.
After 8 long years.
It feels like a weight has been lifted. But I do have plenty of gaming new business to get to. So, first of all, Xenoblade. Been playing it quite a bit more since last week. I think I'm about 12 hours in. Still not a whole lot to report. Obviously, James has discussed the game extensively, but one thing we haven't kind of touched on since we had the game, is, you know, between us playing it and stuff, is the voice acting.
Yeah. I actually had a question about that, so go ahead.
Well, I don't know whether I'll be able to answer it, but 12 hours in, you can get a pretty good idea of the quality of it because there's already been plenty of cutscenes and whatnot, and I'm pretty happy with it. I mean, as I kind of hinted, looking at pre-release footage, the babble stuff in the battle is a bit grating, because it's, you know, obviously you hear it plenty of times, as you'll do plenty of battling, and I just don't like that stuff in general.
It's very conversational too. Like, the three people will have a conversation specifically sculpted for the three of them being out there.
Yeah, I mean, you could see they've put effort into it and stuff, and I kind of appreciate that in one sense, but it still doesn't make it natural. It's just too difficult to make it seem like a natural conversation when you're going to be having this conversation many, many times.
That's what makes it worse, though, because if you use the same party a lot, which you can because it levels up non-active party members too, what you're going to find is you're going to hear the pseudo-flirting of two characters so much you're going to want them to both fall off a cliff. Shut the hell up, Ryan.
I thought you were just going to say fall in love and get on with it, but no, apparently just wants
no,
them
I
to
just
die.
Want them to stop talking.
But, you know, the actual dialogue scenes, you know, it's not spotless, and I think there's probably a few times where you feel like, perhaps predictably, there could have been a bit of trimming gone on associated with, you know, a bit too much exposition, maybe as a sort of product of its Japanese origins, but not too many complaints on that front yet, even though the early part of the game is probably always going to be the worst for that. So I think it's fine, actually. I mean, I don't know how people in America would react to it, being that it is like a British voice cast and stuff, but I think it is the same people that did Dragon Quest VIII.
Oh, really? I thought that was perfectly fine.
So if you've played Dragon Quest VIII, that probably gives you a relatively good idea of what this is like.
Is there a Genghis-like character?
I don't think so.
Cor blimey.
But what struck me at the point that I've got into the game is the Mechon voices. They're funny.
Oh,
because they're, yes, they're like these what I suppose in British parlance can only be referred to as geezers.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna eat ya. Look.
Yes.
what the hell?
You have this early on. They establish this antagonist robot, and he's like a silent killer. You know, he looks pretty mean. He's got like knives for fingers and jets on his back, and he does something pretty awful early on that the characters want to get back at him for. It was like, oh, this is a scary bastard. And then you get one Mechon character that's not him. It's like, okay, well, right, he's got this crazy over the top, like, Londonish voice, like, okay, but maybe he's just like a buffoon villain. You know, there's plenty of those in RPGs, you know, like Ozzy in Chrono Trigger or something. But then the primary antagonist, Mechon, speaks for the first time not long after that, and he sounds pretty much the same.
He does. He never gets better either. Like, he gets more and more over the top as the game goes on. So it's like, oh, just die.
I'm not sure I've ever had a bigger mismatch between what character looks like and his voice ever, but I guess if it's a machine, it doesn't really have to have any relation.
I'm excited to hear this. It sounds fun. My copy's on the way. It's somewhere easterly, and my Wii is hacked and ready to go.
He has a scene in which he talks about making people bleed that is both horrifying and hilarious at the same time.
I'm saying like he's going to be getting into sort of Python territory.
I don't think intentionally, but he kind of does.
Yeah, I probably not intentionally, but I'm happy with it. I think the storytelling seems fine so far, and it's just a very pleasant game to play because the soundtrack is very nice. And so far, yeah, I really haven't had to do any grinding or even mess with the sort of arts, you know, the special moves that you use in battle, like leveling those up to the maximum extent. I mean, I've done some of it, but yeah. I probably could have had a more sort of optimizing approach than I've had, but I just haven't had to because it's just been sort of pretty smooth sailing so far, and it'll probably change in the many, many hours I have to go.
Much, much later in the game really stands up in your way, but for a long time, the game is pretty smooth. It sort of difficulty curve spikes at the end when they're like, oh crap, we're at the end, we need to do something.
Let us announce to you that this is the end. I mean, I think that's sometime is the intent.
Like, this guy you're fighting, yeah, he looks like any other enemy, but he kind of is in the way, so we're going to make him hard as shit.
But I've also been playing, as I suggested last week, Aliens Infestation, which arrived a couple of days before its European release date, and then there's a couple more weeks, I think, or something left till the US release date.
And our friend Craig Harris produced this game, by the way, for Sega.
Yeah, I guess when he got there, maybe he sort of got it back on the fast track to actually getting released or something.
You know, that's interesting. I maybe we can get him on the show sometime and ask him about that, because I'm sure Craig would have, you know, being that he ran IGN's handheld portal, I'm sure he would have been very much exposed to this game in the earlier years where it was being shown off a lot before it went silent.
Well, I mean, also, he was working with Mark Bozon, whose brother is very high up at WayForward, so he would have had plenty of knowledge of this game.
Yeah, I'm sure he played many early prototypes of it, so I wonder if he went into Sega and said, hey guys, I think we can make this a success. I mean, I don't know if he would have that much pull early on, but I know that he's also working on the Aliens Colonial Marines game, the console game that's coming to Wii U sometime next year.
Yeah, so it's finally here. I haven't had a great deal of time to play it, but I've already got a pretty good sort of feel for it. So obviously, as you will have heard on this podcast and probably other venues when discussing this game, yeah, you can see sort of Metroid and Contra in it. But the thing that's interesting about it is, in many ways, I would say it's slower paced than either of those. Because the kind of action that you're dealing with is not quite the same sort of run-and-gun style as Contra. It's a bit slower paced, especially in the early going of what I've played so far, in that what will happen is you'll actually have humanoid enemies at first that are shooting at you from like behind cover, basically, so boxes and stuff, and you can attach to cover as well, so you're kind of just shooting at each other from relatively close range, peeking out over these crates or whatever, which I saw in a review over here was described as police squad style combat. You're sort of just shooting at each other blindly, missing most of the time. It's not quite as bad as that makes it sound, but I can see how they got there. Once you get the timing down on how long they take before they sort of peek out, you could nail them with pretty good reliability. But the point is, you're not just blazing through everything and all that. It's kind of a slower pace, tense, at least at first. And your main character's movement speed, by default, is quite slow. But then they've got this dash meter, which if you hold down the right shoulder button, you can actually go really quite fast. So that's good for like sprinting away from stuff at times, and just for sprinting through corridors where, you know, you've been through there before. You know there's nothing kind of to see or worry about in them. And then you have this roll dash move, which uses up quite a lot more of the meter, which is very useful for like dodging, especially when you get into some of the boss fights. So that's kind of, your character's not that mobile by default, but then, you know, he's got this sort of limited amount of pretty high mobility. But you have to be careful about how you manage it, because that gauge, you know, if you drain it all the way down, before it can kind of regenerate, you're going to find yourself kind of helpless if you time it poorly. But then, in terms of the Metroid-style stuff, yes, the main location of the game, the Sulaco, is much like that, in that you've got all these places where you can't go yet when you first get there, and then you'll come back having gotten, say, for instance, like a welding torch, which you could use to open certain doors you didn't have before, that sort of thing. I mean, it's going to be interesting as the game progresses what sort of empowerment progression there is, because it's not as obvious as something like Castlevania or Metroid. You know, you're playing as these marines, they're not gonna sprout wings and turn into a bat, or they're not gonna get a screw attack. They might be a bit closer to keys, you're literally being keys, and some of them are literally keys, than you'd like. But I mean, it seems relatively well put together as a big space so far, and then you've got these levels that sort of branch off from that, which in themselves have non-linear aspects, but it's not, you know, to the same extent, because you're not going to be coming back to them afterwards. And they also have like some set pieces in there. Like one bit you're in one of those armored vehicles from Aliens, where you're kind of using the touchscreen to man a turret gun to blast off all these aliens which are just coming after you, and then you like crash into the big ship from the original Alien with that crazy, I think they call it the space jockey, the thing that was piloting it, in the background. I mean, it's weird. It's got this kind of comic book aesthetic going for it, especially with the characters. But on the other hand, some of the backgrounds do a fantastic job of translating the matte paintings that were used in the original Alien to a video game. It's really good. They evoke it very well. That's the thing. I mean, as an Alien/Aliens kind of tribute, it's pretty spot on. I mean, the sound effects are perfect. You know, the pulse rifles and that weird sort of not at all menacing little squeal that they had in Aliens, which I always thought was weird. Like in the first one, it doesn't make a noise at all. It's just scary. Whereas in the second one, they sort of had this weird death squeal, which is translated over to this. But you know, it's authentic. And definitely once you start doing battle with them, the Xenomorphs or whatever, they're quite frightening. And obviously what they build in with the map system is the motion tracker thing. So on your lower screen, you've got the motion tracker sort of running so that you could see across like all the rooms that you've been in before, like the little dots where there's something there. And sometimes they do the old gag where it's like a cat in the vent or whatever, and it comes out with a stupid loud noise. But it will tell you roughly where the enemies are going to pop out from. So on the one hand, it has a lot of enemies just bang on top of you. But on the other hand, you can actually be prepared for that. So it kind of sticks true to, you know, what an Aliens game probably should be about, because that's what the movie was about, was just stuff popping out of the walls. But at the same time, it's not too cheap in the context of the game, because you've got this motion tracker.
Now, earlier you mentioned going through a corridor where, you know, you could dash through it because you knew nothing was in there.
Yeah.
But to me, one of the big potential, you know, cool things you could do in an Aliens game is you could have the aliens sort of tracking you down and hiding in places where you think are safe, you know, places that you're very familiar with. Does that happen?
Well, it's too early to say whether they're going to mix it up in that way. You know, I mean, just in the first couple of hours of the game, whether they're going to kind of subvert some of your expectations about what are and aren't safe places.
Yeah.
That we'll have to see. But it's kind of cool as well when you go into places that are off the map, which tend to be like these vents and stuff. So you'll go into your network of air vents and the map is just a black screen, but you could see all the little white dots like lighting it up. So, you know, there's just going to be shitloads of them when you get there. It's pretty cool. And that typically is where you'll have like a whole bunch of aliens like nesting or something. And if you lose like one of your guys, sometimes you get the chance to actually find him and rescue him. But he complains of like feeling nauseous and stuff, so you know he's just gonna have a chest burster come out of him at some point as well.
Nice.
If you don't just get him killed first with being rubbish at the game, of course, you can spare him that particularly unpleasant experience. But that's the thing. They basically function as lives, these Marines. And like you've got four in your squad at any one time. If you lose all four, it's game over. If you lose one or two, you can find a Marine that's just like a straggler. The rest of his group has been killed or whatever and add him to your party. And so, you know, he's basically like an extra life. But the only thing is just that they don't have like unique capabilities or anything like that. They do just sort of have different character art and they have somewhat unique dialogue that's, I guess, just been tweaked for different characters. So it looks good so far. I mean, like I said, my concern, I guess, really is compared to games of his ilk, is it going to have the kind of environmental variety and the kind of empowerment path that we get in Castlevania and Metroid, which are, you know, more outlandish than this? You know, this is more grounded. So it's kind of interesting how they're going to square being faithful to the alien sort of universe with having a sort of interesting later part of the game. And also how much the combat kind of amps up. I mean, you do get different weapons, which play quite differently, and you can find upgrades for those. So you're definitely looking in nooks and crannies, much as you would do for a missile tank or something.
Yeah, I think I'm really interested in this, and I'm probably going to pick it up. You know, I was kind of waiting to hear what you thought of it and what other people thought of it, and it sounds really good. So I'm probably going to pick this up in a couple weeks when it comes out in America. And it, you know, some of the stuff you just said makes me think about Colonial Marines, which is a first-person shooter for consoles. And like I said, it is coming to Wii U, although they haven't shown that version of it yet. Randy Pitchford talked it up real big at E3, and he was really excited about it. And it sounds like they've been working on it for quite a while, since early this year. But you know, I wonder, in the same way that this 2D Aliens game picks some things up from Metroid, I wonder if the first-person HD console game will pick a few things up from Metroid Prime. Because if you think about, in the first Metroid Prime, when you're in the ice region and you're in the lab and the lights go out and you have to use the thermal vision, and you've got space pirates who are clinging to the ceiling, you know, they're on the bottom of catwalks, they're up on the walls, and they kind of jump out at you. It's a very Aliens kind of a scene, and I could definitely see the Aliens console game sort of picking up on that and translating it back into the original Aliens universe. So, not that that scene is particularly Metroid style, it's more Alien style, but I wonder if they'll use that as kind of a scene as a bridge point from which they can actually base a number of elements in the game on Metroid. In other words, you know, I wouldn't expect that these little space marine guys in the Aliens universe to be collecting power-ups and becoming more and more powerful. I think the, like you said, the empowerment sequence has to be a lot different. But you could still definitely do things with puzzles and with the way that the rooms are put together and then, you know, and with the atmosphere that could be very reminiscent of Metroid Prime.
And of course, it could almost be a preview in terms of whether if we have the Wii U version, it could almost be a kind of preview for some of the sort of integration that you could see if they brought back Metroid Prime for Wii U in terms of how it uses the controller screen and all that kind of stuff. It does, because it's first person, because it's all about, you know, through the helmet, you know, that's a big theme in the Aliens movie. You know, they've got all the screens with all the Marines, like what they're seeing. It's got that same through the visor kind of thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of how that interface, you could kind of keep the primary interface sort of correct for that to be immersive in terms of through the visor, and then put a lot of junk, including the motion thing,
on the
controller.
You could really play up the horror element there. Like, you can look down and you'll see all these little dots come up. And, you know, you don't see anything on your screen. Maybe you hear something, maybe you don't. Maybe you hear something from the left or the right or behind you or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential there for sure. All right, John, you're up next.
One of the games I've had on my backlog that I've always been curious about was Shadow Complex. And so, you know, I kind of, a couple of days ago, I threw a few hours at it, put it down, and didn't come back to it for, you know, a few more days. And then finally on Sunday, I sat down and I started playing it at about probably 10 in the morning, you know, just kind of like, I'll throw a couple hours at it. About 12 hours go by and I pretty much just played the whole thing all the way to the end. And there's, you know, the 21 challenge rooms. I played through all of those except the last one, which is just pretty much really, really, it's really, really tough. But yeah, I mean, it is, I mean, in so many ways, you could call it a ripoff of, you know, Super Metroid.
Well, and the developers were straight up were like, that was our inspiration for this game. We wanted to make a new Super Metroid. And I think they did a pretty fucking fantastic job of it.
Yeah, it is really fantastic. I mean, seldom do I sit down and marathon an entire game all the way to the end. But, I mean, it's just, it kind of shows me, I mean, or even non-marathon it all the way to the end.
Or just play it in general.
Unwrap it, if you will. But, yeah, I mean, it does so many things right. I really wish that this is the kind of Metroid that we would have gotten instead of Other M. Even though it's a very tried and true design, I mean, I just always enjoy playing this type of platformer. Like, the only thing I didn't get was the fusion helmet, so I don't know if that gives you, like, kind of morph ball powers. That's the only thing I missed, is that...
Oh, no, it doesn't do that. I'm trying to remember exactly. I think it makes you invincible while you're shooting or something like that.
Yeah, that's about the only thing I missed, is I wish I would have had, like, a kind of like something that would be equivalent to a morph ball, because that was the one thing where I was like, how are they going to fit that in? I don't really see anything in the design that, you know, can necessarily, like, let you, like, there's no little hidden areas where, you know, you could only get into if you rolled up into a ball.
No, but there are a lot of ducts in the walls that you can crawl through.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's kind of how they replaced it. You know, there was a lot of, and they replaced it. So one of the things that I do like is that they give you the flashlight on your gun right from the start that lets you kind of see. They replace the colors on the Metroid doors. They replace that with the flashlight that lets you, you know, you shine the flashlight on a door, and if it glows red, you have to use a missile to open it. And, you know, it's really nice seeing this type of game not on, you know, some older hardware. It's really nice. And just, and also the fact that it's not set in space and it's not set in some castle was kind of cool, you know, because, you know, you're out, you're in the woods, you're going across a lake, and that was really, really cool. And just the fact that, you know, they can do a little bit more, having bosses that look really, really good and are actually kind of, you know, large, and, you know, they come in from the background and attack you from, you know, the foreground and everything. It's really, really well done. The story is
stupid.
Forgettable. I mean, I don't even really know. I really don't even know why they kind of had it there. It just seems like a prop completely. I mean, you're chasing your girlfriend, or not even your girlfriend. I don't know, some girl. It's not even really touched on. It's like, you know, she gets kidnapped, and pretty much there's really only about 5 or 6 story points through the entire game where it actually goes into a cutscene. So I kind of felt like they missed an opportunity there. I felt like they could have, even though it's supposedly, it's based on...
It's Orson Scott Card. Yeah, he wrote the premise of the story, I guess, or he wrote sort of the outline of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had someone else write in all the dialogue, I think. But yeah, it's like, what's the point of getting in a famous author when you clearly don't give a shit about the story in this game?
Yeah, and
I mean, they didn't even try to present an interesting story.
But yeah, the only other thing I really have to say is that I liked the way that you can tell exactly where to go next. Like, you know, you have like a blue line on the map that pretty much plots out your entire path to the next objective, which normally I'd be like, you know, whatever, you know, it's some sort of super guide, I win button sort of thing. But I actually like the way that it lets you just kind of move on and enjoy playing through the game rather than trying to, you know, backtrack and, you know, try to figure out and try to recall, like, where did I see that? I saw this door somewhere and I can't remember. And you have to, like, you backtrack over here and you realize that's not where you wanted to go at all. And so you have to go all the way across the map and jump through a bunch of hoops and get killed a couple of times. And so being able to, like, you know, say, okay, well, my next objective is here and that's how I get to it. And if I want, I can kind of deviate off that path and explore an area that I can now get to because I have this item. So that was actually pretty nice. And really, I enjoyed the game a lot more. I mean, heck, I sat there and played it for like 10 hours straight and went through the whole thing. So, but yeah, I mean, anybody that likes Super Metroid and you have a 360, definitely. I mean, it's one of the best games I've played for 360 by far, and it really makes me want this type of game in HD on Wii U.
With Metroid, yeah.
Yeah.
With Samus. And
yeah, I want, yeah, a Metroid game like this.
Yeah, it's the 2.5D Metroid that we've wanted since DS first came out,
yep.
Basically. It's pretty much Metroid Dread. I mean,
yeah.
It's like the sequel to Metroid Fusion that everybody wants, and for whatever reason, Nintendo just hasn't been making it. I don't understand why, but I'm glad these guys did.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if... I mean, it's funny because it seems like it would be such a safe bet for them to make. Like, I just think that the way that Metroid has kind of done so-so, you know, over here, that I would think that they would keep making safe bets like this rather than do kind of weird off-the-wall stuff like Other M.
It's weird, yeah. I think Other M must have been an attempt to get the Japanese market interested in Metroid, which failed completely.
Yeah.
And it pissed off most of the Western audience, too.
It's probably the nail in the coffin for that, I would imagine. And I also imagine it was probably a passion project for Sakamoto. This is something he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's probably the last chance he's going to get at that kind of a thing.
that ship has sailed now. But if you want a sort of optimistic look at it, you know, if you look at the last time that sort of happened on a smaller scale, but you went from Fusion, which is more guided and more scripted and a lot more dialogue and all that stuff, to Zero Mission after it. You know, it was a, sort of a more of a reversion to Super Metroid. So presumably there will be more Metroid games. I think a similar U-turn is probably in order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's a proven market for that series. So there's no reason for it to go into hibernation. They just need to probably scale back the production, spend less money on it, and make the game that the fans want.
I would think by now the market that does exist for it is relatively well known, so it becomes a question of calibrating the costs according to that, as long as it could still support a rewarding game design, which I have no doubt it could.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who loves Metroid who doesn't want more Metroid. I don't think anyone's sick of Metroid. All right, well, I'll go next. I've talked recently about playing a lot of Final Fantasy VI, and I did play more of that this weekend. Actually, I'm getting pretty far into it now. I'm hoping, I don't know when Xenoblade's going to show up, but I kind of like to finish Final Fantasy before that, just so I'm not playing two really big RPGs on my Wii at the same time. But actually, this week, I'm going to talk about a different game with the number 6 in the title. And that limits it to a very limited number of franchises. I'm sure you can guess where this is going. But I recently picked up Dragon Quest VI again. I had been playing it, I think, before E3 was sort of the last time I played this. I'm borrowing it from Nathan Mustafa. And I started playing it around that time, and I put about 20 hours into it, which is not hard to do on Dragon Quest, especially when it's portable. You know, it's like Pokemon. Pokemon is like Dragon Quest. But, I mean, you can imagine, it's a very low-intensity game. It's easy to pay a small amount of attention to it and continue to make progress. And, it's very easygoing. It's something that's very easy to do while you watch TV or watch a movie or something like that. And so it's easy to rack up a lot of time on it very quickly. But having laid off of it for 2 or 3 months, I mean, really quite a long time, I went back to it because I'm borrowing it. I'd like to finish it and send it back to Nathan so I don't keep it forever. And I had no idea what to do when I turned it back on. You know, I'm like, I wake up at a church somewhere. I don't know what I was doing before I quit. I have no idea what to do next. I don't even know where to go, what to look for on GameFAQs to try to figure out where I left off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, I remembered that there's a fortune teller in the game. And I warped back to her. And turns out she is really, really explicit about what you need to do next. So it's a great feature if you take a long break from this game, you can go back to it, and she will tell you exactly where you should go next, which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And including, not only did she tell me where to go next, you know, if she just told me the location, I probably would have had to look it up online to figure out where that is, because this game has two world maps that are pretty big. And they link, but I don't currently have complete access to just kind of go wherever I want between the two. So it's like the location I need to go to could be in this one world, but in order to get there, I'm going to have to start out in the other world and go from this town and go find a cave somewhere that leads to a staircase that takes me to the other world, and then, you know, walk around for a while there and then find this new castle, and then there's the cave nearby it where I have to go. So it could be like a fairly complex route in order to get to it. Any game with world switching, you know, you tend to get these kind of interesting paths from one place to the other. And that is one of the pleasures of this game, is kind of seeing how the worlds link together in various ways. But it makes it difficult to jump back into it. But the fortune teller did one better, and she actually told me, like, very specifically which town to start from, then, like, walk south for a while, and then go east, and you'll find a cave. I mean, it's like, it was that level of detail. Yeah. I was like, this is great. This is exactly what I needed. And then from there, you know, the game, I mean, the events and the locations in the game tend to link pretty well from one to the other. So once I was back on track, it was not hard. It's a game where you don't easily become lost, I don't think. But actually, right soon after that, I found a flying bed, which is sort of like your airship. And it can't take you everywhere. There's still some mountains that you can't fly over. But it gave me very open access to one of the two worlds. On the other one, I only have a ship. So it's a little more restricted on the ship where I can land and explore. But anyway, it turned out there was a lot of world map that was suddenly opened up to me, which means now there's myriad locations that I can go check out, and I'm not totally sure which one is the next big location, but it almost doesn't matter because there's several different things I can sort of check out. I found the Metal Palace, the Mini Metal Palace, which means you can start to rack up a bunch of really good items, and basically, I ended up putting like probably at least 10 more hours into the game over the weekend. It's a great game to play while you're watching college football, which is what I did. And yeah, I ended up playing a hell of a lot more of it, and I like it a lot. I mean, at this point, I've played every main series Dragon Quest except 7, so it's almost hard to figure out which game is which because they're all so similar. You know, there're modest differences from one game to the other, and some of them you kind of remember certain things that stick out to you. The thing that will stick out to me after I'm done with this game, years later, I think back, what was the difference between Dragon Quest V and Dragon Quest VI? The main thing is that there are two overworlds, and so there's a lot to explore, and the story linkage between the two is not that interesting, and you kind of figure that out early on. But the really cool thing is like I said before, the traversal of getting to one place by going through the other world and finding a well that you can peek into that transports you to a certain place in the other world that you couldn't get to before. That stuff's really cool. And so if you really like the overworld part of 16-bit RPGs, then I think Dragon Quest VI is just about the best you can go. Now, if you really like the overworld part of 3D modern RPGs, it sounds like Xenoblade is your best bet. And so I'm really excited about that too. But as a guy who likes exploring worlds and likes finding little nooks and crannies and secret places where you can get special items and talk to people, I'm a pretty big fan of this. And so far, I do think I like this quite a bit more than Dragon Quest V. Even though, you know, people like Jeremy Parrish think Dragon Quest V is the best because it has the best story. Maybe that's true, but the best story in a Dragon Quest game is still not a very good story. And that's kind of how I feel about 5. Like, it's about family, and it's kind of takes place over, you know, 30 or 40 years of the lifetime of this guy. But I don't really care, because they're so cartoonish, and the characters don't really have much personality. So a lot of it's just implied, and it doesn't really work for me. So this one is much more up my alley, and I like it quite a bit. So good job to 8-4 for localizing it. And I think, you know, these Dragon Quest games, 4, 5, and 6 on DS, apparently have not sold very well. And I think it's too bad because, you know, 4 was available on NES for a short time. It was a very, very late NES release in the US, and not many people played it. And it's definitely one of my favorite in the entire series. It's a great, great game. And the structure of that game is really interesting. I've talked about it before. But 5 and 6 had never been released before in America. You know, this is your first opportunity, and if you like Dragon Quest IX, and I know a lot of people do, you really should go check out these games, because you might think that it'd be taking a really big step backwards, you know, and that they'd feel kind of primitive compared to 9. I don't really think that's the case. I mean, for one thing, the series is obviously famously stagnant. So it's not really that much different, even though they're much earlier games. And for another thing, the people at Square Enix and whatever the name of the company is, that's Art Piazza, I think, is the name of the developer that's been remaking these for DS. They've done an excellent job of upgrading the graphics, and they've spread the environments across both screens, so you see kind of a lot. It's interesting to spin the camera around and see everything in three dimensions. And the animations are really fun. The music's very high quality. So I don't think there's a huge technology gap or a sophistication gap between 4, 5, 6 and Dragon Quest IX, which, a lot of people have already played. So I hope people will go back and check these out, because they're really, really good games. The only other thing I had this week, and I won't spend long on this, but I did download Four Swords, because that was the free, the free Zelda 25th anniversary thing they did, and you can get it on 3DS, or if you have a DSi, you can get on that too. And I guess they're supposed to play together, but I haven't gotten to try the wireless yet. I was afraid that I wouldn't really get to play much of this, because I wasn't sure if there would even be a single player option, but there is. And it's similar to the GameCube game Four Swords Adventure, and that one you had four links, and you sort of could put them in different formations, and it was really clever how they did it. And it was still very fun to play through it, even by yourself. In this one, you only control two links if you're playing alone, and you just use L and R to switch between them. Or you can pull them together, you can call one link to the other, and just have one follow as you control the main one. And I've only kind of done a couple of the tutorial levels, so I really don't know how deep this goes. I don't know how much content is in there, but it looks nice. It looks a lot like Minish Cap. And you can tell that Grezzo, the same company that did Ocarina of Time 3D, they've put some work into actually redeveloping this for the DSi and the 3DS. For instance, one thing I noticed is that you can push X to call the other link over to you. And I thought about that, and I was like, that must be a new feature, because the GBA didn't have an X button.
Yeah, the single player is a new feature altogether.
Yes. Oh, really? So the entire mode is new? Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, so it's almost like getting a brand new Zelda game that you've maybe never played before, and it's free. So pretty sweet. Big ups to Nintendo for doing this. I don't really know how good it is yet, but it seems likely that it will be very good. And I'm definitely going to be playing some more of that this week. So maybe next week we'll talk about it. I mean, we've all got it. Even John can download this on his DSi, so we've all got it, and hopefully we can all check it out.
Yeah, I downloaded it yesterday when it came out here, but I am saving it because I will have the chance to play actual two-player, at least some of it, so I'm awesome. Kind of holding off at the minute, because that's how it's really cool that they've got that one-player mode in there.
Yeah.
But it definitely seems like a pretty unique opportunity. It's so sad. It's like, I could have played, if there'd been a Four Swords, the GameCube game for Wii, I could have played that, because, someone else with a DS was fine. But GBA not being as popular with the cables and all that, wasn't going to happen. It's just so sad that they didn't get around to it on Wii. But this is going to make up for it a little bit. And who knows, maybe it could pave the way for bringing it back in some fashion for the next console, or goodness knows what.
Yeah, I could see that. And I actually might get a chance to play this with a friend over the weekend. I do have a friend who has a 3DS who I might see this weekend. So I'll mention it to him. Maybe we can do that. But yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's flying a little bit under the radar. I don't think Nintendo's done a great job of promoting this, but it does seem to be a kind of an underplayed game, an overlooked feature, because it did require so much extra stuff, back when it came out on
and
GBA.
People.
Yeah. People. So I think this is a great opportunity. I mean, it would be better if it was online, but hey, it's free. I'm not going to complain about lacking features. Obviously, they have put a lot of work into it. So I'm excited to try it out. All right, James, why don't you wrap up new business for us?
So one day I'll get to play in Inazuma 11, but that day hasn't come yet because it's butt deep in review time of the year. So if you go to the site, you'll have seen the Hatter review go up this week, and I should have one go up next week. And this time it is for Bit Trip Saga, which is really my first long-term experience with the Bit Trip franchise as a whole. Hmm. And instead I got it in one package of, I'm not sure what adjective to use here. I'll have an answer for that when I actually write the review.
Bitness?
Bit.
So this is new bitness actually for you.
B- fitness. Yes.
Oh.
Thank you, John.
Oh, well done.
I just made that
sir.
Up on the fly. Hey.
Oh.
I don't know where this comes from.
God. Neither do we, John. Neither do we. So I've gone through all the games. I've played each of them for at least an hour. I figure that's a fair time to give each of them. Some of them have gotten more if they're more substantial experiences or I enjoy them. Obviously, the big difference between this game and its individual predecessors is that it implements the 3D functionality of the 3DS. Varying degrees. So Bit Trip Void, I believe, is the one I'm thinking of. The one where you're just the blob and you're trying to pick up the black dots and avoid the white ones.
Yeah. Do you like that one?
I do kind of like that one.
I liked it a lot, and because I've been reading reviews of Saga on other websites, I've heard a lot of people shitting on Void.
I would say it's one of the more mindless games of the six, which is I'm fine with that. But I mean, it's not a super involved game like some of its peers.
It's easier than some of the other ones, but I feel like there's a little
definitely.
More flexibility in how you play it. You know, it's not as regimented as Core. Like, Core is like playing the piano, and if you don't hit the note right, you fucked up. You know, there's only one correct way to play some of these games. In Void, I feel like there's more latitude in you know, you can challenge yourself.
Yeah, so Core is the one where you have to hit up and shoot or left, right, and down, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
I still kind of struggle with the names a little bit since I took them all in at once.
That one's brutal.
Yeah, I actually find Core to be utterly unfun, to use a non-word.
I think people like it because of the music. But it's probably my least favorite of that entire series.
To me, it felt like the most primitive game of the lot. And one of them is, or two of them really, are Pong variants.
Yeah.
It felt like something you would have played in an arcade in 1978 and never seen again.
Right. I mean, it's pattern recognition, which I can respect as a game design. But it's pattern recognition, like, stripped down to the most fundamental
Sure, and I'm pretty good at pattern recognition, so I do pretty well in the game. I just don't find it to be fun.
Yeah.
It's so primitive that there's really only five states of gameplay in the game. Up and firing, left and firing, right and firing, down and firing, and not firing. I mean, that's it. That is the entirety of your input choices.
Yeah.
I just find that game to be, A, it gets brutally difficult, and B, just not very rewarding.
Yeah.
Bit Trip Beat, obviously, Genesis, is entirely and utterly unnecessary as it's been completely eclipsed by Bit Trip.
Fate,
yeah, which is pretty much Bit Trip Beat in that everything in it is better.
Yeah.
So, like, I played them in order, and I'm like, God, I really don't like Bit Trip Beat. And then I got to Fate, I'm like, I really like Bit Trip Beat when it's this game.
Yeah.
So, this is one of the real issues I've had with the game, is that each game has its own control style, except for Fate and Beat, because they're essentially the same game. And for those two games, for whatever reason, they've wired up the circle pad, or the slide pad, like it's a Jack Russell Terrier on cocaine. Like, even the slightest tap shoots you to the very top of the screen.
Well, I guess this is an issue of translating motion controls in their original form
right.
to a more traditional style.
Yes, and other games that use the pad don't seem to suffer from this, but for that particular game, it renders them unplayable, so you have to use... Thankfully, they included stylus controls, but that is absolute position on the touchscreen determines where you are on the... Mm-hmm. On the view, so it's like it's point to point. So if you were to tap somewhere up the screen, you'd jump to there on the top screen.
Sounds useful.
It's in a way, if you can game it, it is kind of useful, but it's really hard to game it in the moment.
Do they give the option to turn off 3D and use motion?
Not that I've seen, no.
That's weird, because that's how you played it on iPhone, and of course it's how you played it on Wii.
Right. Once, with the exception of the fact that you have to kind of claw hand the 3DS if you're using stylus controls. I find the stylus controls of those games work fine. And in general, the controls in the game work fine. It's just that one particular game, for whatever reason, the slide pad is completely insane. Let's try to go through them. So I've talked about Fate, Beat, Void. Runner, its 3D effect is actually rather muted compared to the other games. But
really?
Part of that is because if you put anything bright on a black background with the 3DS's 3D effect, you can actually get the optical illusion of it floating above the screen. Because the screen bezel is black.
Yeah.
Like, your brain is thinking almost like it's coming out of the screen. So a lot of the games, it looks like there's depth into and out of the screen. With Beat, Runner, obviously.
It's the most colorful of the games.
So the 3D effect looks really flat.
The other thing I heard is that it kills the frame rate when you turn on 3D.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Now, obviously, but this is a situation which would be more apparent to someone who has played the game before, which most of the reviewers have, but it, to someone just on the face of it, does it seem obvious that it's chugging a bit?
So here's how I could tell it was kind of chugging. There were periods where it would drop, but generally speaking, it was my eyes were telling me the frame rate was really low. Like, my eyes were kind of straining on the frame rate a little bit, if that makes sense. So, even with the 3D turned way down, the eye strain was still kind of palpable. When I turned it all the way off, though, it was fine. And, you know, the only game that's really given me 3D eye strain was playing Ridge Racer, for extended periods of time. But that's because the 3D effect in that game is just over the top.
Yeah, in the best way, I think. I think it should be over the top because there's a slider. So,
yeah, but even on the lowest setting in that game, it is bombastic 3D.
Well, it's very noticeable, but I play Ridge Racer when I play Ridge Racer, which is not often. But when I do, I turn it all the way up because the thing is, that's like the only 3D game that I really have other than Excitebike. So if I'm playing Ridge Racer, it's because I want to see some damn 3D on my 3DS for once.
And some of the games, the one where you're on the line.
Oh, Flux.
Flux, yeah. That game is...
It's a cool idea, but it's poorly designed as a shooter.
Yes, that is my feeling.
I would love for someone else to make a shoot 'em up in that style, but I don't think these guys know how to make a good shoot 'em up.
Yeah, it just didn't feel right.
It looks cool, but...
It does look cool, and in 3D it looks really cool because you get that... When the vid ribbon splits into three colors, when you get to the maximum whatever they call it setting, in 3D that generates a really neat effect. The game as a package is great. That's a lot of game. I mean, if I just go and play, like I've played Fate a lot. I'm on the third chapter and I got to the third chapter's boss starting the game fresh. So first time I played Fate, I made it all the way to the third chapter's boss because I just played it straight. Because I really enjoyed it. Versus the other ones where I was doing like the sampler. I'd play it for a little while, jump out, play the next one for a little while, jump out. I've played Runner a lot. I've made it to the second area. But, I mean, just for those two games, that's a decent amount of gameplay. I mean, I could see myself playing those regularly. Now, there's a cost analysis you have to take into account. But if you can get the game at a relatively decent price, I think those two would be enough to justify it to begin with.
Well, to be fair, the standard retail price of Saga is you're saving, I think, $2 if you bought all of those on WiiWare. But the thing is, on WiiWare, you can kind of pick and choose. So
right.
if you do your research, you say, I don't think I would really like Core based on what James and Johnny said, then you don't have to. And then you're already below the threshold for Saga.
Or you could say Beat no longer has a reason to exist.
I think Beat's fine, but it's definitely easier and simpler, but at the same time, it doesn't have the checkpoints that Fate does, so it's
no,
actually
No, it doesn't, and that makes it just unbearable.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're at the very end, and start over.
It's a rough game. Like, you have to really want it to actually get through Beat.
But now, of course, we've got the additional issue of Complete, the Wii game.
Yes, which I believe adds more content to these games, correct?
Content and online leaderboards.
And it's the same price. So it's a question of whether you want portability in 3D or do you want the best versions of these games.
Yeah, and like these games make perfect sense as train games.
Yeah.
I mean, you could put your headphones on and go into your trance mode playing this.
They're really intense, though. I'd be concerned about being distracted.
Yeah, I'm a bit sleepy on the train to be playing something like Runner from my experience of playing it at home.
If people are bumping into you...
See, that's kind of for me on these games, though, because when I was playing Runner, when I had my best unintentional pun run at it, was when my eyes started to kind of get, like, almost lose focus, but I was just sort of... I wasn't thinking about what I was doing anymore. It was just happening.
It totally has that Tetris zone-out effect.
But it's still a question of reflexes and being quick. It's not really... If I'm groggy, that's the problem, not how crisp my eyesight is.
It wasn't just an eyesight. It literally felt like I was about to fall asleep as I was playing it. But as soon as I died, I was right back out of it. I was like, oh, that was weird.
Yeah, it's like being at a Fish concert.
And then I looked up, well, that's the Wii, Johnny.
That's the Wii talking.
I went, oh, God, hardly. I made it in five levels? What the hell? What happened? I kind of like games that can do that. And to me, that's the first time I've had that experience in a while. So in a way, it sort of goes back to the old Gradius games where I got to my best when I really wasn't aware of how well I was doing.
Well, Gradius has reasons for you getting on a roll with the power-ups and stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, with Bit Trip Runner, it really is. That's the thing. It's so reduced down to the absolutes, you know, you hear these cues and you just respond to them in the correct way. You can still get on a roll, though.
Yes.
You know, so you get into that sort of zen state and just keep reacting correctly.
I'm pretty sure a marching band could have come through this room and I wouldn't have noticed at some point. I mean, it was in fucking tense.
Yeah, Bit Trip Runner is maybe my game of the year for last year. I mean, it is a spectacular game. But keep in mind, on WiiWare, that game is $8. So if that's all you care about...
Yeah, I mean, for me, Runner of Void and Fate is enough for the games to hang around in my travel case.
Yeah, and on WiiWare, that's $20 worth of games. So the question is, are you willing to pay the premium? And you know, and certainly if you haven't played them all, there's a chance that you might like all of them.
Sure.
But probably you will find that three or four of them you like a lot more than the others. But it sounds to me like Complete is... These are games that personally I would prefer to play on the console because they're so intense and so timing-based.
See, that's kind of the opposite to me, though. These are the kind of games I want to play when I'm doing something else.
Wow, I can't imagine doing something else while playing these particular games.
I had relatively hyper television on when I was playing Flux, and that was fine. I could get through it. But for me, it's just, I don't want to be tethered to the TV. Like, this is a game for me that would be great on an airplane.
Well, yeah, the airplane makes sense from the point of view. At least you would be sort of transported away from how grim and mundane what you're actually in is.
Yeah, I mean, an airplane is possibly the most soul-crushing thing that's not a Greyhound. So,
if on the other hand you were using it to sort of take you away from how grim and mundane whatever channel you put the television is on, well, then that's your problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, for me, it's just kind of this... This is the kind of experience I want on a handheld, something that's very heavy rhythm-based and relatively simplistic, but still challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of go either way with it because these games are so old school. You know, I can see how, you know, you might want to play it like while you're on the run kind of thing, but also to me, just because of the kind of zone-out factor, it's really nice to just sit down on your couch and just throw it into the console and just sit there and play it for, you know, spend maybe 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
I will say the ability to suspend these games is probably something that would have been nice on the Wii version. I mean, you could leave your Wii on, but you're probably not going to want to do that. So I've left particularly good runs through Beat on and just closed the 3DS, put it on the charger, and then just went about my day.
Well, that's the one where you would actually need to because
there's no goddamn checkpoints.
Yeah. I mean, like in Runner's broken up into segments that are, I mean, some of those levels you can beat in 30 seconds, so.
Yeah. The some of those segments are kind of long, but they're not super long.
Yeah, they are long, but I mean, I could never imagine reconvening in the middle of it and getting it right either. I mean, I think that probably happened a couple of times just when I had to pause the game on Wii for a few seconds and come back and it just broke my rhythm. It broke my flow.
Speaking, what I find with Runner is that if I have to put it down, it's usually because I just can't get through this one jump and it's become sort of this mental block and I put it down and come back and just wipe the floor with the stage. It's because in my head I've played it more times I know all the jumps now. I don't need to even see the game.
I know what you
mean. And then I just come through and smoke the hell out of it.
I think it's, you know, not that I'm an expert on Rhythm Heaven, but I think very likely if you like Rhythm Heaven, then you need to play Runner.
See, I would say it depends on why you like Rhythm Heaven, because part of the reason why you might like Rhythm Heaven is the comedy of it, because Rhythm Heaven is itself a very funny game. And this game isn't a particularly funny game.
No.
It's not charmless. I mean, with the aesthetic and all, but it's not overtly funny.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with reviews, and Neil has reviewed one of Nintendo's DS Swan Songs in Kirby Mass Attack, in which Neil observes that one Kirby is fun, but 10 of him are amazing.
Much like Greg Leahy.
That's good. God forbid that there should ever be more than one of them. And somewhat less genial tone in the next review from James. Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor Overclock. James, of course, has talked about this on the show before, but just to give you an idea, he opens the review with this salvo: I'm not exactly sure they know what overclock means. So start as you mean to go on, eh, James?
It's funny, if this was a PSP game, it could actually overclock the system. I don't think Nintendo allows that on theirs.
All right, and more reviews. Dan Koopman has Escape Vector Chapter 1 for WiiWare. He says, what lurks inside your Wii CPU? An awesome game, that's what.
Leave your stereotypes about Australian developer no at the door with that one, because that is them, apparently, but it's good.
No journals included.
And also a feature by Danny Bivens, the Japan eShop Roundup. He says that Link and Samus are available on the same day this week in the eShop. That is Metroid 2 VC and Four Swords for DSiWare.
Jared Rosenberg has impressions of X-Men Destiny, the Wii version of Silicon Knight's take on the X-Men franchise with video footage from the game's first 40 minutes.
Not quite a quick look, but...
Well, it's 40 minutes. We also have impressions of Tetris Axis for the 3DS from Neil Ronahan. He says, quote, Tetris is always fun. The AR games, not so much.
All right, well, we've got a follow-up to the feature on Mother 3 by Nate Andrews. This edition's called The Thieves of Justice. You might remember we covered this game in a retroactive a little while ago, so if you want to hear more about it or if you missed that, this is a good way to catch up on the game that was never released in America. And finally, we are hiring a website programmer. So if you are interested in helping out to make Nintendo World Report a better website, we sure could use the help. So please check it out. There's a story up on the site, and we've got all the information there. We would really appreciate it. Okay, that's all the great original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. Please go check it out. Okay, we're back. It's time for listener mail. The email address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com.
Send us all your hypothetical stat sheets.
James has the first letter.
Eric writes, all right, Greg. As a diehard Buffalo Bills fan, I've been hanging on the edge of my seat to find out whether or not the UK got the 30 iTunes reviews to get you to sing God Save the Queen as Gollum. The Bills won a very quick 2 games. In fact, I'm proud to say we're now 3-0 as I write this. The question is, did you get the reviews in this faster-than-expected time period? If so, let's hear you proudly belt out God Save the Queen for all of Middle-earth to hear. Your brother in the Bills, Eric.
Well, Eric, first of all, obviously, I vastly appreciate any Bills fan listening to the show. We need to stick together. But let me do you a favour here when you're discussing this amongst fellow Bills fans. There is no need to say, as a diehard Bills fan, whatsoever. If you are still a Bills fan at this point, you obviously die harder than John McClane with Wolverine's adamantium skeleton and healing factor. So it's just redundant. You can economize on those valuable 2 words quite easily. Second of all, yes, the Bills obviously are 3-0. As we went, that meant they were 2-0 after 2 weeks, as opposed to 11 that it took last year. So that didn't leave very much time to get an increase in the amount of ratings that we had of 50%, which is what I was looking for. So unsurprisingly, it did not breach the level required for me to belt out our national anthem as a fictional character. Now, I'm not going to say I knew we were going to go 2-0, and I wanted to avoid being humiliated on the podcast with something I'm not really qualified to do, but
unlike some people here,
we were playing the AFC West in those first 2 games, so I'll just leave you to figure out whether I knew this was going to happen or not. But the third win is completely different. I definitely wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected to see somebody get picked off after hitting somebody's helmet and having it go bonk.
It's tragic such misfortune to occur to such a likable team.
Yeah, and such a good-looking quarterback, too, you know?
John, just rain your homoeroticism all over this conversation.
Such a great haircut to have so many interceptions. It just breaks my heart.
That's the thing. If you've seen Tom Brady after we killed his hair, he's cut it. Killed his hair.
He killed it.
That's more impressive than the 3-0 record. If you can mess with Tom Brady's hair,
dude.
He's
been growing it out since 2003, the last time they lost to the Bills.
Not quite, but it was getting pretty silly. So maybe we did him a favor.
Well, it wasn't posing with goats anymore, so it's an improvement.
I would have waited an eternity for this, but I'm very glad I didn't have to. So it's been wonderful. But, you know, the NFL season is vastly unpredictable always. So as I'm speaking now, as people hear it, we could very well be losing to the Bengals. I'm prepared for that eventuality. But yeah, I am grateful, though, for there were a couple of people that seemed to put up ratings in response to my plea, for which I am happy. And of course, despite there being no bargain or anything, I'm still inviting everyone to get that number up so we're more competitive with our US friends.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, I have to say that we got a hell of a lot of correspondence about this.
About the win and about the musical murder that would take place afterwards.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's great. It's so nice that people actually care enough.
I had forgotten the terms of the unholy bargain, but I was reminded after reviewing my email, pretty much right after the game, actually.
It's funny. A lot of people thought of you, Greg, when they saw that the Bills beat the Patriots. A lot of people. We got a hell of a lot of comments on it on Twitter, Facebook, email, TalkBack. It was all over the place. People were like, "What's Greg going to say? What's he going to do?"
I have to say, I did think of Greg when I saw this, and I was actually, because Redskins didn't play on Sunday. They waited till Monday to break my heart. I was in a cafe, and I was having a late lunch breakfast thing, and I had my phone scrolling scores, and I saw the score alert come up that the Bills had taken the lead.
I did the same thing. I saw the score on ESPN, and I was like, wait a minute. Whoa. I gotta go to a TV and watch this. What the hell is going on?
I might have finished that croissant in about 2.5 seconds, and then I proceeded to check my email about the 10 minutes took me to get back to here, and we already had our first email, so we were in good shape.
The world is watching, Greg. The world is watching.
The one thing is the Patriots, you know, they have obviously got brilliant offense, hugely potent, and I can't imagine their defense would be this bad.
Are you reverse jinxing them?
There is no way a Bill Belichick defense could be this bad for 17 weeks of the season and beyond, so they may well have the last laugh on us all, but we don't play each other until week 17, which is in 2012. So for the rest of the year, we own you, Belichick.
All right, John has the next email from an old friend.
All right, our own James Charlton writes, "Just wanted to throw my 2 cents in there on the topic of piracy versus used.
Is he constipated? What are you doing?
All game stores and electronic stores in general in Japan usually have point cards, so when you buy a used game, you get points which can be put towards the purchase of a new game. So in essence, used games help sell new games."
I'm so sorry.
"It used to be the case of game in the UK. Maybe Greg can confirm or deny that is still the case.
It's getting worse.
Also, piracy is often linked to organized crime in some areas of the world.
Where the fuck is this?
Especially places like China, where it's basically production line piracy, making thousands of copies a day. Greg, what you got to say about that, mate?"
I'm going to say sorry, James Charlton. And I'm also going to say that was in fact a condition of John's gaining citizenship to the US, that he had to do a horribly stereotypical British accent.
To be fair, JC's not the only person who's owed an apology for that.
Oh, yeah, I've got beer up my nose, so you can apologize to me,
too. I've got pain in my esophagus.
Well, I only allowed John to do this because I know James is a fan of the show, and I thought he would get a kick out of it. But yeah, James Charlton, of course, he's one of the hosts of our FamilyCast, sister podcast, and is a fan of RFN, and he wanted to chime in on this topic.
Can we review it in English now, please?
Yeah, well, he said that in Japan, when you buy used games, you get points on a card that go towards the purchase of a new game. So, in effect, you know, we sort of said implicitly that used game sales sort of fuel new game sales in America. And he's saying in Japan it's quite explicit that they are very much linked together, and that it sounds like it's almost like not a loss leader, but the availability of cheap used games is a way for stores to get people into the doors, at which point they have promotions that they use to sell them new games as well.
Right, it's a loyalty scheme as well, isn't it? So you keep going to the same place.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So do you know if that is the case also in England?
You see, this is it. I just, you know, as I said last week, I don't buy used games. I don't dabble. I know jack shit about what goes on.
So last year, GameStop was experimenting with something similar regionally, where they've had point systems for a while where you get rewards if you buy used games, but those rewards started to trickle into other purchases. So what you'd get is you'd basically get a gift card from them if you earned enough points. I don't know that promotion ever got extended to nationwide. I know we had it here, and I never earned anything.
JC also brings up another point that I thought was kind of interesting, in that he refers to piracy in terms of like Chinese clone games or knockoffs, basically.
Which, if you buy games off eBay...
It's handheld games.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll say this again. If you buy games in Russia, that's what you're getting.
You have no choice in the matter.
And I own one. I own a Chinese knockoff of Driver for GBA.
I have so many questions, and they're all unanswerable.
Yeah, yeah. The best part of that is the manual, which was the same three pages repeated several times and was for a completely different game.
What makes you think it's a knockoff?
Fantastically hilarious manual for that game. But anyway, it's interesting because that's almost a different kind of piracy. That's a manufactured piracy. And I think that only exists in a certain part of the world, which James, because he lives in Japan, he probably has more access to that kind of thing.
It only gets produced in a certain part of the world, but those games are sold. I mean, you can buy those games anywhere.
I guess so. It depends on where you tend to shop.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if you walk through the gold district of Los Angeles, guess what?
Oh yeah, we've seen that. What was that Pokemon Cobalt or whatever we saw?
There was a lot of different Pokemon knockoffs with various non-Pokemon on the cover.
Yeah, that's true. I guess what we were mostly talking about last week is digital piracy.
Right.
In other words,
at which point no money changes hands anywhere.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, to an extent, there are people who are hosting the websites that have these, and they're getting advertising revenue. So I guess to an extent, they are getting some money.
I think these are pretty much morally equivalent, but it's an interesting distinction that I wasn't even thinking about when we talked about this last week.
See, I actually disagree that they're morally equivalent. I think at this point you're flooding the market with copies that the average unaware person could end up with and assume based on their experience with that the quality in general is shoddy.
That's possible. Yeah, from the purchaser standpoint. I mean, I don't think anyone goes out and intentionally buys pirated Chinese clone games.
No, unless they're looking for these bad clones. I mean...
Yeah, unless you're a collector of like weird shit like that, like James. But
I own two. It's not a collection.
It's a burgeoning addiction.
All right, so Greg is going to read the next letter.
Very well. John, a.k.a. Little Irves, writes, "Love the show. My first dip into the RFN waters was last year's Rondo of Games, and I haven't missed an episode since. Eventually, I hope to mine the back catalogue. Until then, I'll dream scary dreams in anticipation for number 103. To the point at hand, I think Dr. Met's comments last episode with respect to the iOS market not affecting 3DS for future success underestimates the pull of smartphone gaming. The people paying attention to and buying iPhone games are not just those who'd pick up Horses Happy Adventureland for DS, as implied by Johnny's dismissal of the types of customers downloading iOS games. I write for a gaming site full of intelligent, tapped-in consumers, and the forum is constantly discussing a slew of new quote-unquote iGame content. These same people most likely would have been buying DS/PSP titles by the handful 5 years ago. Now it seems they're finding their fix elsewhere, or at least heavily testing the waters. I have both an iPod Touch and a 3DS, and personally I play my 3DS more often and with much more enthusiasm than my iPod. But I wouldn't dismiss the quality of some of these smartphone games. If you know where to look, they are numerous, cheap, creative, and at times the kind of experimental and new experience people would have found on dedicated portable hardware a few years ago. Groove Coaster and Jetpack Joyride being two recent examples. Though I have faith there's room in the market for both models, I'm still worried a generation of portable game players might be weaned off their handhelds without even knowing it.
First off, I want to say, wait, there's a forum about people who talk about gaming maturely on the internet?
Yes, it's at NintendoWorldReport.com.
No, it's not! I'm sorry, Johnny. You can't lie about that.
So the Photoshop abominations involving James' face prove that to be patently false.
That's the least of my concerns when I go in there.
Yes, well, back to the matter at hand. Greg can probably back me up on this, but I don't think I dismissed people who like iPhone games last week. Although I'm not going to say I've never done that before. It wasn't my intent, though.
I seem to recall you calling them tasteless baboons.
What I said was that when I get a smartphone, I don't expect I will be spending much time on those games. And that's a personal thing because I don't think I'm interested in those experiences.
Probably not, but I think you will find that games are better than you think they are.
John, you own a Windows mobile phone. How many games do you have access to?
All the ones that matter.
Elo Milo and...
Geometry Wars.
Elo Milo and Angry Birds. That's all you've got.
I think the point that Johnny was making last week was there might be sort of limited direct substitutability for... You know, I could get a 3DS and play Metal Gear, or I could buy this many iOS games.
Right.
Buy the iOS games.
And then my point in response to that was, well, yeah, I mean, you look at it like that, but the problem is if you look at it in terms of dynamics, this is where John's point comes back in terms of a generation of portable gamers might be weaned off their handhelds without knowing it. It's the people that transition out of traditional portable gaming and the people that don't ever transition into it because smartphones represent another hurdle, that it's not a direct substitute, but it's enough for people to just be satisfied.
Yeah.
Sure. I see your point.
I mean, long term, there's no telling what could happen in terms of how robust the games could get on phones, how many of them might have additional input mechanisms or, you know, whether they'd be needed, who knows. I mean, longer term, it's very difficult to project out, and that's one thing. But if you look at it just in the sort of near to medium term, I do think there's an issue of, you know, there may have been a number of people that bought a DS relatively early on, or maybe, you know, quite recently, and this effect is just lagged according to, you know, how much money they're willing to spend on portable devices in general. But say they bought a DS relatively close out of the gate, and they played a lot of the games that were big on that, you know, Mario Kart, New Super Mario Brothers, etc., enjoyed it a lot, and then... Maybe as time went on, you know, and Nintendo paid a little less attention to the DS and, you know, there's somewhat less prominent titles. They used it a bit less. They had got a smartphone. They started using that more. And then when it comes to the point of like, okay, well, now if I wanted to play, you know, the big new Nintendo game, I've got to put this lump sum payment over in order to do it.
Right.
Then they might look at it in a cold, hard way and say, is that, you know, is it really worth my while anymore? You know, I'd like to.
Well, I think people do that algebra anyway, whether they have a smartphone or not. I mean,
well, yeah,
it changes the math.
You know, so I mean, there always has to be the killer app, you know, mentality. There always has to be the compelling software that makes you want that platform. And that remains an issue for Nintendo with 3DS.
But the difference now is that you've got products out there on the market that are essentially satisfying a certain amount of someone's appetite for gaming. And like you said, it's not the same, certainly not yet, but satisfies a certain amount of that appetite incidentally.
That's right. Yeah. That's the key thing. They're buying that regardless of whether it plays games, but the games are coming to them when they buy it.
So it's almost like you're getting that part of your appetite for gaming satisfied for free. And that in itself makes it seem like more of a painful thing to part with a big lump sum of your cash to actually get a new platform that's all that it does. So I think that is going to be a challenge for both Vita and 3DS for those people whose basically their perception as you know, it's a topic that he was very keen on. The perception of the value of a dedicated gaming device has changed from 2004 to 2011.
Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily agree with that part, with the last thing that you said. But certainly, if we're talking only about the segment of the population for whom video games are a matter of scratching an itch or of having something to do during an idle moment, then I think those people are going to be satisfied with a smartphone. And maybe there's a lot of other people also who are satisfied with a smartphone. If you're really deep into the research and you're going to seek out the absolute best software for it, like Little Irv's here is talking about, these people who have a forum where they discuss, you know, and they get really deep into it and they go out and seek out the very best experiences, then it's quite possible that you could be satisfied on it. I don't think I would be personally, but I'm not saying that some people can't be, and I'm not saying that those people aren't real gamers. But I think, you know, what Nintendo showed with the DS and with the Wii is that it's possible to find new customers. For whatever reason, they weren't your customers before. So in this case, it could be getting people who were only interested in PSP last time. It could be people who are introduced to gaming not by the DS or by the Wii, but by smartphones, and getting them to bridge over to 3DS. So that could be a whole new market.
See, my feeling on this is similar to John's and Little Irv's, in the sense that he says, I have faith there's room in the market for both models. And I certainly have confidence that there is room for both. But that's the point. I mean, you know, as I said last time, whereas they've been on the offensive and aggressively expanding what is their sector, they now have very significant headwinds in that direction, which, you know, again, as Johnny points out, I mean, you don't give up.
They could also change direction to get out of the headwind.
The problem with if you go totally defensive, and as I said, there are, you know, a certain number of aspects of their strategy so far that look totally defensive. It's like, get more money out of the guys that are already going to buy your games by jacking up the price of the software, and initially the hardware was quite expensive too. And also, you know, making these games that are N64 remakes, or the Pilot Wings has sort of brand cachet, or Kid Icarus, or, you know, all this.
Do more with less, comrade.
That all seems defensive. But the problem if you just play defense like that is you will still lose people. Inevitably, just for, you know, there's nothing, you can't keep everyone. People get older, their lives change, they will drop out. But if you're not then getting new people, you've really got a problem. And that's where you've seen it in the past with stuff like GameCube, where they've struggled. So they do have to have alternative strategies for bringing people in to offset an inevitable, and also now I have to say, due to smartphone, because of what I've described, accelerated loss of people from their user base. So that's a nut that they have not really demonstrated yet that they can crack.
Well, I think what Nintendo is having a hard time with right now is that, kind of like with, especially with like the rise of, like, you know, the iPad and stuff like that, is that things have shifted more from the value of games versus the value of the device. So people look at things like, it can play games, but what else can it do?
The point is that as we go forward, the ability of a device to play video games will become commoditized.
Yeah.
No, what won't become commoditized is for it to be able to play Nintendo's games.
Right.
Because, you know, they're going to develop for their own hardware, presumably to the bitter end. I mean, they'd have to, you know, go belly up probably to do anything other than that. And that's where, you know, they have to maintain their comparative advantage with games that are just of a quality steeped in the history that they have as well. That can't be matched elsewhere. And, you know, that's not technological or anything. That's creative.
Yeah.
And so, you know, long term, when all the people that are there now aren't there, you know, maybe that will be difficult to maintain that edge. But in the near to medium term, I think they've got that sewn up.
Well, and I think it's telling that the last first party Nintendo 3DS game was 6 months ago.
Well, I think that's,
I think that says it all, really.
That's there's a few different reasons for that, though. Not the least of which is the 3DS wasn't ready for prime time.
I understand, but if Nintendo's not ready to make software for it, who is? And I think Nintendogs is the only first-party developed 3DS game on the market.
Steel Diver, right?
Steel Diver is kind of co-developed and shit.
But in terms of the actual product of, you know, EAD or something like that, I mean, it's that's a point. We haven't seen the fruits of their labor yet. And
exactly. We don't really have Nintendo games yet on 3DS, and I think that the sales show that. I mean, Greg is exactly right, but you can't hinge the success of a platform on Nintendo first-party games when there aren't any.
But that's what's special about them. It's not, you know, the Nintendo in that little oval. It's the games they make inside the company.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's almost kind of hard for us to discuss this right now, but because we'll have a much better understanding in a few months of how this moves the needle, because they're going to be launching the good shit SS Nintendo all over the 3DS.
Yeah, I think Mario Kart 7 will make a difference.
But I mean, I think the major point, I think, where, you know, Johnny and myself can agree definitely is that, you know, it is going to eat into the smartphone phenomenon is going to eat into Nintendo's sort of ability to sell their products to new customers or to retain the customers they already have, but not at least in the, you know, medium term to such an extent that it's fucking doomsday scenario.
No, absolutely
it is,
not.
It is a threat, but it's also, my point is, it's also an opportunity. And not even to mention the overlap, of which there will be plenty. But I think there are a number of people who could be converted into buying a handheld who wouldn't have before. And at the same time, if the cell phone market does take away some of Nintendo's reliable customers from the DS era, I think it also is a motivator for Nintendo to look at new demographics that they haven't done well with in the past. For instance, there are tons of console gamers who have never owned a handheld gaming system.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like the Wii. Like, is the Wii ruining gaming as a whole, or is it bringing new people into gaming? It probably depends on who you ask.
Way to set up that scarecrow, John.
All right, well, the next letter is from Gordy Piggles. Love that name. Gordy Piggles writes, is there any chance of a Ni No Kuni Wii U port?
Sure.
And I think in answering this, well, yeah, sure, there's a chance. But
I mean, yes.
I think in answering this, it probably would help to explain just what exactly Ni No Kuni is, because probably a lot of our listeners aren't really familiar with it.
Yeah, so I mean, it's the Level 5 developed game in collaboration with Studio Ghibli, the Japanese animation house that produces many highly acclaimed animated films. The IP started on DS, where you had the premium price game with a sort of spell book that you kind of played along with.
A real book, to be clear.
That came on the biggest DS card ever made. You know, the mm-hmm. capacity of it was very big and therefore very expensive to produce. And it obviously seems like it's got a lot going for it commercially, the power of the Level 5 Studio Ghibli brands, but it didn't actually come roaring out of the gate when it went on sale in Japan. Sold quite a few hundred thousand copies, I think somewhere over 500,000 or something like that, but not necessarily what they were hoping for. And I'm not sure how it works in terms of it must have been a very costly game to make.
Oh, certainly.
In many ways.
I think the retail was like kind of equivalent of like $80 to $90.
It was a very expensive it was the Steel Battalion for the DS, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, you had that, but now there's a separate game, but set sort of, I guess, in the same world or whatever, that's for PS3. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, it's rather different, you know, and it's strikingly beautiful game, mm-hmm. As it is, you know, recreating the same art style in 3D, cel shaded, very impressive when you look at footage of it. But, you know, that may come out and do well for PS3. Certain RPGs have come and done pretty well. I think Tales of Xillia has gone off to a pretty strong start over there. But given the fact that perhaps Ni No Kuni has not yet sort of caught fire, and maybe it won't do so on PS3, there is the potential that they might look to port it to Wii U as a way of sort of amortizing the costs of the whole thing, trying to milk it for all it's worth. You know, I think they'd be more inclined to do it if they really are sort of under the gun to get everything they can out of, you know, all this sunk cost of development.
If they're going to do that, don't be surprised if they don't include the spell book and just put it on the bottom screen or on the palm screen.
Oh, yeah. That obviously is not an issue with the PS3 game. They haven't got that, but that's where you could put an... I've said this, suggested this on a previous episode, that you could actually sort of converge if you wanted to do more than just a straight port. The PS3 game and the DS game by playing along with the book, because I don't think the PS3 has that. You know, the game doesn't come with a book or anything.
Oh, okay.
No, it doesn't have a book. So yeah, this would require a bit of re-engineering, but yeah, it's what Greg said. I mean, you could sort of make a hybrid between the DS game and the PS3 game and put it on Wii U so that you could have a digital version of the book that you have on the controller screen and then play a somewhat adapted version of the PS3 game on the TV. I think that would be very compelling. It would be more expensive to produce than just a straight port.
Honestly, it probably depends as much on what they anticipate the Wii U doing in the first year. And right now, I don't think there's a lot of people willing to make that guess, because it's still, even though we've played the Wii U, it's still very amorphous at the moment.
Well, one thing we could be fairly certain of is that this might well be something that Nintendo would be interested in helping to happen.
Oh, yeah, financing.
Obviously, yeah. Level 5 have a lot of pull.
Dinero Sombrero.
But then again, I mean, this IP is not yet... This IP is not yet proven to be a commercial juggernaut, so maybe it's not so much the case. But the fact is, it's something that you could have on Wii U. Presumably, would be terribly hard to do a port from PS3 to the Wii U, and then it could be a nice fit in terms of Nintendo, on the one hand, providing, you know, an experience it could point to and say, look, this isn't just, you know, some quickie thing that's all about asymmetric multiplayer or whatever. You know, this is a full experience, a bit like what we've seen with Dragon Quest X being on both the Wii and Wii U. And then on the other hand, Level 5 has the possibility of saying, well, we could sell this game to people who wouldn't otherwise bought it because they're Nintendo loyalists or whatever, who are getting in on the ground floor and are going to be sort of more open-minded about what to buy when the selection is limited, and this stands right out as being a quality production.
But there's also an opportunity to double dip, and if they do what James suggested and put the spellbook on the screen, then this is now a pseudo sequel. It's basically a new version of Ni No Kuni that plays differently than before. So they might actually be able to sell it to
Triple dip if they sold this game twice to people.
Right.
I mean, they're different games, to be clear. Those the DS and the PS3 game tell different stories and are different games.
They are different games, but it sounds like the DS game, you know, which is already out, people have played it, you know, it sounds like it is a good game in most of it. Maybe it's a bit simple as an RPG or whatever, but, you know, the whole package is very good. There's probably people in Japan that really like that and that would be willing to buy anything with the Ni No Kuni name on it. I mean, that's perfectly plausible to me.
And this sort of goes to the character of the two companies involved. It's not a Studio Ghibli thing to produce sequels, as it were. Mm. At least not in general. But Level 5 is certainly not above that. But they're both not above marketing things they've already created. So it might be in the best interest of this brand for them to perpetuate it in the hopes of generating a marketable asset.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is an investment. It's like, if they think that one day this could lead to a franchise, a perpetual money spinner, if you just keep sort of hitting it hard enough until the fan base is built up, you know, that may well be what they're looking at. So
production of movies, television, books, toys, clothing. I mean,
and in that case, you want to spread it to get that mindshare as far as you can.
It really depends on how much the two parties involved value this brand, and potentially on how much Nintendo values having it on their platform. And certainly it would be something they could show at a press conference, and people would walk away going, that was a news story.
Right.
Now, the PS3 game has also been confirmed that it will be coming across.
Yes.
To the West.
The DS game, not. The PS3 game, yes.
Yeah.
So that is another wrinkle there, that if we do have a Wii U port or something that's heavily based on it, then you would have a translation in place that means that we could actually get the chance to play it.
But that would mean that NOA wouldn't be the publisher, though, which is a little different from the standard Level 5 relationship with Nintendo platforms. So Level 5 could view it as an avenue for them to really get their Level 5 USA and Level 5 Europe branches something of substance.
Right. They do have local branches now. So, I'm excited for Ni No Kuni. If you feel a little bit at sea with this conversation, just go online and find a video of Ni No Kuni. It's NINOKUNI. And check out either version. The DS game is certainly fascinating, although a lot of the most interesting stuff is happening off the screen because it does have this big tome that it comes, the spell book that it comes with, and there's a lot of reading it and researching and translating glyphs from the page to the touchscreen. But watch a video of the PS3 game, and you will be interested in it because it is gorgeous. I mean, really, really beautiful. So I'm excited. I think it would be a great get for Wii U. But we'll just have to see. All right, well, it's time to wrap up the show, but before we go, we have a few announcements to make. First off, there's a new podcast on the NintendoWorldReport.com family of podcasts. It's called NWR Connectivity. The first episode is out. As of last week, we weren't sure if it was going to be ready or not, so that's why we didn't talk about it. But it's now been out for over a week, and in fact, the second episode is probably out. And the basic idea is that it sort of rises from the ashes of Newscast, and it has some of the same people involved, but also some different people. And the idea is that it's broken up into smaller segments, and on each segment, they might have a different group of people. And I think the general goal is to get as many people from the NWR staff onto the podcast as possible. So you should hear a wide variety of voices and perspectives on things. So it sounds like a really interesting format, and we wish them the very best, and I'll be listening. So you should too. I think if you, well, actually I know, if you were already subscribed to Newscast, you should already be getting it automatically. But if not, head over to the website and you should see a link for it right on the front page, and you should check it out. Of course, we always would love to get reviews on iTunes. I know that topic came up on the episode today. So regardless of what region you live in or what iTunes store you have access to, we would definitely appreciate it.
Or what musical interludes you desire.
All you have to do is open up iTunes, go to the store, search for Radio Free Nintendo, and you'll see our podcast come up right off the bat. And just click on that and leave a review, and we would really appreciate that. It does actually do a lot to help people find the show, and so that helps bring in new emails, new listeners, new more votes for Retroactive, etc. It makes the show better the more people who listen to it, so we'd appreciate your help on that. Of course, you can send your emails. We would love to hear from more and more people. We always get interesting emails every week. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And if you can't remember that, go to the site, look at the article for this episode. It will have a link in there, as well as, on the sidebar, links to all the games that we've talked about that are in our database. So it's a really good resource for you to help go find more information on anything that interested you, that you heard about on the show. There will also be, in that article, a link to the new Retroactive poll. And one of the things that I kind of wanted to move towards in the future of the Retroactive is to reduce the number of games that are in the polls, because that will sort of coalesce the votes, and I think it'll give more games a better fighting chance of getting selected.
One party future.
It'll make everything more fair, I think, in the voting. So for this Retroactive, and actually, before I get into this, we did put out a call for suggestions and ideas, and I think two of these three games came from suggestions in the forum thread. So thanks to everybody who put up ideas there, and we will go back and continue to mine those for future editions of the feature. So if you do have an idea or something comes to you, that forum thread is always there. You can always go and throw in your 2 cents, and we really do look at those, and we use those ideas in the polls. So the three games that you have to choose from for the next Retroactive is Mario Tennis Power Tour for the GBA, famously given a score of 10 by Stan Ferguson, and mocked on something awful sometime later than that. There's Custom Robo for the Nintendo DS.
Custom Robo Arena.
Arena. Okay, yeah, there's a few different versions of Custom Robo out there, but the one we thought sounded most interesting, and I think the one that was suggested in the forums, was the DS version. So that should be an interesting one. And then John came up with this idea, a virtual console game, River City Ransom. It is the 25th anniversary of Kunio-kun.
It reminds John of home.
Yeah, so it's a very famous sort of beat-em-up slash RPG. It's similar to Double Dragon. That's a pretty good idea of what this is, but there's a little more depth to it, and it has a pretty famous two-player co-op mode.
And it's 100% less dragons.
And that is on Virtual Console for NES. So there you go, Mario Tennis Power Tour, Custom Robo Arena for DS, and River City Ransom on the Nintendo Entertainment System, or Famicom. So if you have any interest in one of those games, I would strongly encourage you, and indeed implore you, to check out the Retroactive poll thread. There will be a link in the article to this episode. Or you can just head over to the Nintendo World Report forums and go to Podcast Discussion. You'll see it there. You'll have a couple of weeks to vote, And then whatever wins the poll, we will play, and we hope you will play as well, and we'll talk about it on a future episode. So get over there, man. Send us an email, review us on iTunes, check out Connectivity, and vote on Retroactive. There's your homework, folks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
There was a moment where the fourth pick happened. I can't stress that enough. Fourth
yes.
interception that went back for a touchdown, where this noise escaped me. I don't think I've ever made it before. It was sort of a cross between shrieking and howling and laughing. And I realized that I just cackled like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Can you try it for us?
No, this is not a discretionary noise.
Well, Johnny, I would equate what he's describing to the concept of the rebel yell, which no one could replicate after the war because they weren't hungry anymore. And Greg's hunger was satiated by the defeat of the Patriots.
Yeah, unless you're a collector of like weird shit like that, like James. But
I own two. It's not a collection.
It's a burgeoning addiction.
Yes,
it's a gateway drug.
Jesus! Didn't you ruin this letter enough already, John?
Hey, you know.
I think though that
I'm an artist.
The potential impact.
He's an artist.
I painted a picture with the way I read the letter, James. I mean, I'm sorry if you're not transported to Great Britain with the way I read that. I can't get through to you.
Where every man is Dick Van Dyke.
I have not drunk nearly enough for this podcast, apparently.
Swig.
Of what? Turpentine?